Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Hey everyone, welcome to the second half of our Pragmatism, William James, how all these ideas and sensibilities play themselves into Mormonism, into religion in general, into faith crisis. I'm grateful to have Randy Paul, Chris Nagley, and Jared Anderson with me, and I teased it at the end of the last one, and so here we are going to go again right into this very interesting section in the book Pragmatism. Pragmatism is a series of lectures that William James gave, collected into a book, and it's a thought experiment that he proposes, or at least it's a way of getting to human temperament that he sort of proposes. And it's a piece that I believe his words, the words of Sterling McMurrin were, is it's a passage that would warm any Mormon's heart. Is that what you guys remember? Something in the McMurrin thing? I should have looked it up.
Sounds like him.
Yeah, but it's a passage of scripture, or no, hello. It's a passage, like I say, from the book.
You wish, Dan.
Yeah. Personal scripture here, baby. You know, never has any passage struck the heart of man as this one mine. No, just teasing. But let me go ahead and just read, you know, probably a paragraph and maybe a few lines from some future ones, just to sort of put it out there. But as I mentioned in the tease, it kind of evokes a little bit of counsel in heaven, but I want to go deeper than that with it. So if I'll just start, if that's all right. So suppose that the world's author put the case to you before creation, saying, I'm going to make a world not certain to be saved, a world the perfection of which shall be conditional merely, the condition being that each several agent does his own level best. I offer you the chance of taking part in such a world. Its safety, you see, is unwarranted. It's a real adventure, with real danger, yet it may win through. It is a social scheme of cooperative work genuinely to be done. Will you join in the procession? Will you trust yourself and trust the other agents enough to face the risk? So that's the main section there where he's got God, you know, supposedly in a thought experiment putting this to you, and he basically is saying, would we join in? And James goes on to say that he basically talks about how there's a healthy-minded buoyancy in the human spirit, and he says, most of us, I say, would therefore welcome the proposition and add our fiat to the fiat of the Creator. And then he says, yet perhaps some would not, for there are morbid minds in every human collection, and to them the prospect of a universe with only a fighting chance of safety would probably make no appeal. Then he goes on to say, there are moments of discouragement in us all, when we are sick of the self and tired of vainly striving. Our own life breaks down and we fall into the attitude of the prodigal son. We must trust the chances of things. We want a universe where we can just give up, fall on our father's neck, and be absorbed in the absolute life as a drop of water melts into the river or the sea. But he basically says that that's the exception. He thinks most human beings, so this is his claim about human character, would want to take on a challenge like that. So a few things to note there. Certainly we have this idea of a council in heaven, not, you know, in any kind of way there. But if we can look at that, we absolutely have a laying out of two temperaments that in some ways some would say could map onto the two temperaments that are proposed, you know, in the Mormon story of Jesus, Jehovah, and that of Lucifer. The one that says, yeah, hey, it's a risk. We're going down there. Are you guys ready to dive in with it? The Mormon story probably downplays the idea that James has that it's a world not certain to be saved, even though we've got wonderful passages of scripture that basically say, you know, and even this idea of a war in heaven that follows the council, there's aspects of Mormon people, and I know Randy and I, in our crazy talking through the years, we always talk about, it wouldn't have been a real war if there wasn't a chance that Lucifer actually could have won out, right, Randy?
Right. There's in some sense,
we think, you know, using Milton's poem, we take recourse to literally ordnance and artillery and a war that is violent in that sense. I don't know what war between eternal beings who know they cannot die is.
Yeah.
But it was something that mattered to all of us deeply. To make any sense of that story, there was something there that really mattered. And so it pushes the whole idea of the sovereign God mystery to the hilt. If God truly did have all power and was sovereign, there wouldn't have been a war.
Right.
The mystery of the infinite regression and the power of God being, as it's mentioned in the 121st section, not being his technical capacity to create worlds or to do pyrotechnic miracles, but his ability to persuade other eternal souls without coercion to engage in some loving way with him. That's his power. And that was what was at risk. That was what was being challenged. And he didn't want to lose. So there was an alternative. The alternative, who knows what it actually would have been, but that there was an alternative, that there was a council, that very mythic tale, that it resonates with us as something we prefer to what James would have called a sovereign block universe in which everything was always established all the way. There's no real risk anyplace. I think that's the Mormon sensitivity that really resonates with the Jamesian sensitivity.
Right, absolutely. And again, it's not typical Sunday school Mormonism. It's not the emphasis. We tend not to emphasize within Mormonism any kind of weakness of God. He's, for all intents and purposes, the average sound that you would hear from Sunday school or people is that God pretty much could do whatever God wants. But when we do push Mormon teachings and the metaphysical sort of sensibilities that underlie it to it, then it is a definite match here with William James in that way.
Oh, for sure. And I feel like it's right. I feel like it's right under the surface, or it's right on the edge of people's thought process. I mean, any Mormon would be familiar with this idea that God would cease to be God. And my favorite chapter of scripture ever, Moses 7, where you have the weeping God.
Exactly.
And the weeping, Moses 7 does it, wrestles with the power of God. And I don't want to go too much into this where we are right now. But Moses 7 wrestles so beautifully with the power of God. Because Enoch says, you know, what are you doing crying? Because you're so powerful. You know, you can create so much. Your creations extend forever. And then God talks about his limitations.
Right.
God says, yes, I am the creator of all these things, but I am weeping because I keep asking my children to love each other and they won't. So it's quite a profound meditation upon the limitation of God.
And Amen.
So even though, like, you know, as you said, a lot of members wouldn't explicitly label that, I think it's very native to our tradition and they would recognize it once it was pointed out.
I agree. Before you guys jumped in, I was like, I had one more sentence on the tip of my tongue, which was, but then if you were to just say anything in this direction, they would all recognize, oh yeah, that is Mormon.
Yeah, sorry.
That is part of us. No, it was perfect. But that's almost, you know, those who've been listening to me in this podcast for multiple episodes, you'll always hear me saying, one more question. Take it one more notch down, and even if it sounds like it's not the standard boilerplate stuff that we all who are listening to podcasts like this are sort of tired of, I always say, man, people will recognize it if you just push it that one step in there, and they'll recognize that it is part of the tradition. And in that way, you know, our tradition is so much broader and bigger than so many people want to give it credit for. So,
which is an argument for staying engaged. I mean,
exactly.
I would agree with everything you guys just said, just a quick anecdote. I call it the pregnant moment of silence in the lesson. when you push it that far, everyone then in the room realizes there's a self-critique of their own view of the sovereign God, And I say that's when the moment that the Spirit is working on them to think about things in a different way, to reject an old idea. It takes a while, but if they think it enough, they become contaminated with this idea that the power of God is loving persuasion. Therefore, we have an enormous power over him, and all eternal beings do. And if you are out for godhood, you got to take the weeping with the smiling. And I say, and that's why I can see at least a third part of us. I'm not saying that it was a numeric third, but whatever the consequences were, we didn't want to be theoretically having this downside of pain. I mean, it's an enormous downside. Those of you who have children or things have gone very wrong, there's an enormous downside of pain with love.
Yeah, and Chris, I know you wanted to jump in too, but before I forget that, because Randy, you just set us up for the thing about the Satan's plan. We always want to say, well, he wanted to force us. Really, I think we can fairly read the Mormon scripture this way, and we certainly could read the Milton poem this way. Satan was just saying, come on, guys, what's wrong with the status quo?
Yeah.
I don't want the risk. You know,
right.
it's more like I want something more than this genuine chance that the world might win through if everybody does the level best, and I have to trust everybody else to really make the plan work too. I'm not for that. I just want to keep things the way they are. So I really like that. I think it's a very fair Mormon as well as broader reading of the war in heaven. But Chris, you wanted to jump in right when Randy did.
Yeah, I wanted to just sort of press on this idea of a limited God. I think what a lot of people do, and I've done this myself, is we'll pick whichever God suits us to sort of make ourselves feel better about any given situation. So a limited God is really good for a couple of things. It's really good if you're trying to explain why there's so much evil in the world, right?
Right.
You know, he's limited, he can't do much about it, we're pretty powerful, so if we want to be evil to each other, he's got to respect our right to be evil, right? But an all-powerful God is really useful for a bunch of other things, like making sure that it all turns out the right way in the end, right? And making sure everything in the world makes sense and has meaning and is important. So a lot of
trade. I would push against that, though, Chris. I don't see... So again, I mean, I've talked about this on other podcasts, but I think in a discussion, and again, I feel like this is a little bit of a tangent, but this question of what is God, we can only engage with it in what definitions of God does the evidence allow for and what definitions of God are useful. And I feel like this idea of a truly omnipotent God fails on both points. But anyway, I don't know if we want to get into this right now.
Yeah,
interesting topic. Maybe
interesting
on the
thing to bring up another time. I don't know if that it's possible to disprove a omni God, like an all powerful God. Like I'm not sure, but
I would agree from a practical and anecdotal point of view. Anyhow, I haven't done the survey with what Chris said, that the idea of certainty in our lives is appealing to many people at many times in their lives, and that idea of certainty goes back to a foundationalist philosophy based on a God who will make things right. There will be justice in the long run. We can be certain of that. That self-story is comforting. So if that's what you were trying to say, Chris, I'm with you on that.
Yeah, and that I get kind of like an eschatological omnipotence. Yes, and eventually, in the end, all things will work out. That performs a very important function in people's lives. I agree with that.
Well, I think just to underline it before we move on, I have a friend. He's a Christian philosopher, and he thinks that all of the evil in the world is basically because God's trying to send a message. It exists because God created the world such that the Holocaust would exist, for example. And what he gets from that is God's in complete control over everything, including the most evil and horrendous things that have ever occurred. God willed those things to occur. So they mean things. They're significant. They aren't just the machinations of depraved humans, even though they are also that. But God made the world the way he wanted to make it, as opposed to things being out of control, meaningless, contingent. And that brings him a certain degree of satisfaction, even though he has to deal with the fact that God has to have a good reason for the Holocaust, for instance. So there are pros and cons to both of these, but it's just an interesting trade-off.
Yeah.
That's again a conversation for another time, but I think that has staggering ethical ramifications. And I'll end there, but
of course. We're just talking about why one would even begin thinking it.
I can't follow down that road, but it's an interesting path.
And William James ultimately would claim that he thinks more people are the healthy minded, or at least I don't want to use that term because there's a technical meaning to that one in the varieties, but more people would want to go with it. In other words, it just in that little passage I read, he was setting us up for, there are times in your life where you might feel this, but you know, wait, give yourself a little bit long, the storm has passed, you've remarshaled your sources, this is human nature to really go for it. And I think in many ways that's what Mormonism says, at least about those souls who chose to come to Earth. You would have to say that at some point, you know, quote unquote, keeping their first estate meant that they would sort of match up with this sensibility that James says about human beings. So,
yeah, and Truman Madsen used to say, Dan, that if that was our temperament in the first estate, it's probably still somewhere down there in all of us.
Yeah, even if life's kicking our butt for a while. Yeah,
or no matter what we're raised as, or what religion we've been taught, or what culture we're in. That's why he thinks Mormonism has a chance of resonating everywhere.
Interesting.
Because we came a little bit wired with that sense of adventure.
Cool. Good. Well, good. And this is a natural segue, I think, this sense of adventure and whatnot, into another famous phrase, and I teased it again at the end of the last one, several times it's come up. It's the term the strenuous mood. And Randy, I know that you and I, in the book that we've written together and the work that we did with the foundation and stuff like that, we often will talk about the strenuous mood. Do you mind introducing that concept within James to the audience, and then we can just all riff off of it?
I think the best thing in common parlance would be to say living life with gusto, serious gusto, enough gusto that gets you through the crappy times where you see that everything matters. Everything matters. Everything you do matters. Every day can be momentous for you.
Yeah, and tied in how I probably didn't set it up well enough, how religion plays into the strenuous mood, why he thinks that you can get to that sort of sense of the most zest better from religion than anything else.
Ah, well, we're back almost to Chris's point, that to posit, and we don't posit it when this is actually happening in our guts, we're not positing anything.
Good call.
When we deeply feel that we are participating with a greater power that's on our side, that they that be with us are greater than they that be with them. that gives us a definite, as James would say, the blood is up. He would say, it gives you a thrill in your soul that even though it appears you're underdogs, this can be won. This can be won. And it can be won for the right reason and in the right way. So it's that sense of there being a deity or a god or some powerful participant that is not obvious to everyone, that is, if you do it the right way at the right time, is on your side and that can bring you to victory. And so that strenuous mood is not a nihilistic, I am the captain of my fate. You know, it's not this, I'm going to do whatever it takes and give the finger to the universe and to any gods that be. It's a different mood. It's an optimistic mood that makes everything important. Even the mundane stuff in life can be, if you see it in the eyes of a god who's your partner, who has placed you here, as Mormons would say, you have a mission, brother. You have a mission, sister. You know, you've got a mission. That to have a mission is to live in the strenuous mood. Okay.
Yeah.
It's that sense of and why it was so unique that James is calling it out in his context. You know, Nietzsche, in his own way, was another voice for the strenuous mood, but he was in an aesthetic. Nietzsche took it to the aesthetic side, whereas James took it to the ethical, interpersonal side very much. And that he felt that's where religion took you, better even than art.
Okay. Right, and Randy, there's a famous phrase, and so Jared, we'll get to you in a second, but you haven't mentioned the driving everything else to the wall. So it's again, this is another passage from Will to Believe. The strenuous type of character will, on the battlefield of human history, always outwear the easygoing type, and religion will drive irreligion to the wall.
That's it. That's what he's saying. That quote came to my mind, believe it or not, guys, when I saw the two towers go down. I just thought of that quote. And I thought, what would it take? Now, I am not lauding those murderers, okay? I'm not lauding those murderers. Listeners, I am not lauding any murderer. But I had to ask myself, if I had a degree in engineering, what would it take? And I had a wife and kids and some money. What would it take to get me to go learn to fly an airplane, kill thousands of people and myself? What would it take? And it's that thing that bothers so many secular and other people, non-secular people in the world. It's that deep idea that religion can take all other competitors to the wall when it comes down to it. When you do believe that you're partners, so to speak, with someone who will make it all right, it just changes your whole attitude on life. And think of what we could do as a people, as human beings, if we were living not to kill people, but to uplift them, thousands of them, giving our lives in uplifting ways, not by killing, because we're living with that conviction that we really want to change the world for good and that it counts. Our lives count and we're going to make them count. That's the strenuous mood.
Good. Jared, you wanted to jump in.
Wow. I just feel chills listening to that and thinking about this concept. And I mean, it really is kind of a spiritual, strenuous experience listening about. And I hope that our listeners will really ingest this, because I think this idea of a strenuous mood, whatever you call it, is perhaps the most powerful element of religion. And you know that, I mean, as a religion professor, and we're trained in religion, Dan, we look at things from multiple sides. And I have to agree, I don't know if there is anything that motivates more people more powerfully than religion. I mean, yes, I believe that humans individually can evolve to such a point that they're actualized enough, that they're motivated by other things. But just as a general engine of action for good and harm, yes, the caveats are important, but I don't think we need to let it trouble us. We need to look it in the face. Is that religion does do tremendous good and harm because it is such a powerful engine. One thing that, you know, I've thought about a lot and I think about on a regular basis is, as human beings, our motivators are so flawed. We are so, you know, we are not really rational creatures. It's been evidenced, you know, by studies that even if we like to think ourselves rational, and you talked about this last hour, I'm pretty sure, Randy, we aren't that rational. We have these deep, visceral reactions. And so I cannot think of anything that motivates quite like religion. And what you just articulated, Randy, is one of my greatest passions in life, is what could we do? What could we do if we could pipe and filter through the noblest, most beneficial ideals through the channels of the motivation of religion? Sometimes I think about, like, what if the Pope preached humanism? And there are problems with that, of course, you know, but just that basic idea of what if we could take the very best ethics, the very best ideas that we have access to, and get them through the traditional religious channels. There's something that really lights me on fire about that.
You need to join Randy's foundation, brother. That's exactly what the whole point of it is to take this energy that's either stalemated or deadlocked or frozen in the ice and unlock it, or to simply rechannel it to honor the intransigent of the other person as somebody that's feeling this deeply and needs to be loyal to their God and to their truth and to their community, and you know, take that warrior spirit that they have and just show that is wonderful, and then just kind of aim it in a different direction, and wow, we could unlock the ice flows.
Sign me up.
All right, you're signed up. You'll be getting the materials in the mail soon.
The donation request first. Yeah. Chris, anything you want to jump in at this point?
I hope this doesn't turn the conversation too far away from that. I only have one thing to say about the whole thing. The strenuous mood, I don't know how I feel about it. What it brings to mind in me is that Yeats poem, the best lack all conviction while the worst are full of passionate intensity.
Right.
Seems like when you have the tiger by the tail, about the, you know, the best thing you can do is hold on, and the worst thing that can happen is it'll turn and rend you, right? And the 9/11 comparison I think is apt. You know, not to channel the new atheist too much, but because I'm not a huge fan. But for me, it seems like these forces are more uncontrollable and ephemeral, and you know, they seem to be operating on a completely different level, divorced from reason and the other things that I feel like I have a better handle on.
Yeah, you know, and that actually fits where I was going to go to, because Randy, you kind of emphasized the idea of a God or infinite beings on our side, and that is a piece of the strenuous mood. But I think there's plenty of passages in James, Chris, that sort of at least hints in your direction of, you know, the more is simply the more. It isn't super directional. It is power. There is, you know, there's things below our consciousness that when marshaled in a certain way will lead and will be effective, but they are not necessarily driven, you know, certainly with James, he's not claiming a God, but there are these powers. And so I'm with you.
Can I throw in something really quickly? Kind of bringing it to the ground, Chris, and I don't know how this plays out really. Anecdotally, it seems to resonate for some people at least. So what we have in Mormons, for example, and I imagine in any sort of intensive religious socialization, it would have the same thing. What about adherents who no longer accept the full narrative? So in Mormon parlance, you know, what about disaffected Mormons, for example? So what we have is individuals who are socialized to, one, work in groups. And I think this is true of humanity in general, but it's so true in Mormonism. And then, two, we're socialized to give so much. I mean, Mormons have an amazing work ethic, and we have this amazing sensibility of sacrifice, of building Zion. So I realize that some are burnt, and that's true. But Chris, do you think there's anything to this idea that is perhaps a demographic ripe for enlistment for a more humanistic cause?
I'm not sure. Generally, I don't have a very well-defined philosophy of sort of social action. I usually take things a person at a time. And as far as being able to marshal anyone on more than a one-on-one basis, I don't know how much interest I have for that. Just because I feel like I want sort of personal relationships where we can appeal to our shared values, our shared experiences, and things like that. I don't see a very good way of rallying any groups of people to do anything separate from methods that I would view as taboo. So things like...
It's called Facebook, Chris.
Okay, Facebook might work. So setting Facebook aside, though, the things that generally get large groups of people to engage in orchestrated, concentrated action are generally just a couple things as far as I go. And we're going a little bit off track. But if you have religions, and they kind of, in my view, tend to appeal to these sort of mythic, symbolic structures, shared beliefs, a lot of times those beliefs are communicated socially. But ideally, those things are internalized and then personalized, right? That's a healthy religious view, but I don't know how many people achieve that. And then things like patriotism, sort of tribal affiliation, those sort of things. I really prefer personal relationships and reason, persuasion, and logic. That's one reason I like James so much, is that seems to be what he's into too, you know. So,
well, crisis motivates like nothing else. You know, you think about riots and, on the positive side, activism post catastrophe, and that's one of the potent things about religion, is it constructs crisis. Which I don't want to get too much into it, but it evokes this narrative of life and death and war and crisis, again, for good and ill. So much rich stuff to dip into that we don't have time for.
It really is. It really is. A couple thoughts I had coming out of this before we kind of just turn it over for more of a free-for-all. And Jared, I know you'd pre-circulated some things you want to talk about. So just one thought is there. I just wanted to loop back to, I think it was Chris's example of the difference between Paris and James on the question of something like when somebody looks at transubstantiation, the Catholic idea here. You kind of talked about how Paris would have no interest in it at all, but James would simply see it, and you almost said it in the last hour. He would almost say, like, look at what they're able to do with this. Look at the potency of this idea. Look at how that can play out and energize lives. You know, it can kind of send them into the strenuous mood. And so James would say, when it comes to the absolute truth claim of this, he would imagine, I think, that idea has cash value. Again, we've talked about that phrase, but we really never spelled out. Ideas and truths have cash value, and there's only a certain amount of cash that an idea like that would have. But he'd say that is a great one to get people to unite in a certain way, to do certain things and whatnot. So therefore, transubstantiation is quote-unquote true in that way, because it somehow aligns in a way with the forces of whatever's going on and motivates. But, and here's where I want to kind of tie it into faith crisis. And, you know, these podcasts a lot deal with folks, or at least we're always aware that there's many that listen here who have had their worldview crash and burn. And that you might even liken them to someone within the Catholic tradition that had, you know, thought transubstantiation made perfect sense, and now it quits making sense to them. And they're like, that just starts the ball rolling, and they start deconstructing everything else and things like that. And there's this tendency just to want to say, it's all BS, instead of, you know, kind of falling in a pragmatic vein, like James would say, and say, great, you've got to the edge. Now, you know, how do you turn your idea, or how do you find cash value in a different way, or how do I pick up the scent one more time of things that take me back into the strenuous mood? Because a lot of times when we hit these faith crises, all of a sudden our mood to do anything in the world has fallen apart, right? So I don't know. There's this something on this. On this cusp of the strenuous mood, the failure of that strenuous mood when we hit a crisis, and then the desire and the way that pragmatism can kind of say, keep pushing around, keep experimenting around, push through the end of your cash, push through your poverty for the moment, because there are truths that will, you know, encompass them all again, and you can regain that sort of orientation and whatnot that the strenuous mood talks about.
Let me say this, that this ties back, I think, Dan, and gives me an opportunity to respond to what I felt was a critique of my view that James would lean toward optimism when it comes to any form of theism. And that is what you just described, is pushing through. As Pascal would say, you look up at the stars, and some people, I'm paraphrasing, some people get nauseated at the emptiness of it all, right. and others in a strenuous mood are totally inspired by being part of something so great. Okay. And I think that the whole undercurrent, the sentimental or temperamental undercurrent of James's theism, is this optimistic side of whatever God is. If it's an evil genius, or if it's a totally amoral pure life force that doesn't give a darn about anything except change, then that gives you a different mood than if it's a being that cares about you and your well-being and cares about your desires and others and their well-being. There's that difference. I just wanted to put it in there that I think he would argue strongly, and it's in his work when you see it, the final book he wrote, The Pluralistic Universe.
Right.
There's no question that he's leaning toward the process God, if you will, being one that contains something like love. The Eros is not amoral in the sense of anything goes as long as it's more. The Eros of a divine Eros, at least, as James would say, at least the God he wants to worship. Because
right.
he believes in pluralistic deities. There isn't right there a strenuous competition, if you will, Dan, between a nihilistic divinity that might be real, a negative divinity, an evil one that might be real, and one that we would call a loving or caring divinity that wants to somehow collaborate with other beings for their mutual well-being. So I just that's my spiel.
Could I step in here? I think I'm just speaking to where I am in my faith journey, but this is actually a criticism I have of my own position. It is what we're discussing is a check against my own current inclinations. Because one thing that it's important to ponder is what are the benefits of a literal belief that are harder to access elsewhere in the journey. So I consider myself to have a mystical temperament. Like I have both simultaneously a mystical and critical temperament at the same time, which is useful. But so I have had these very dramatic spiritual experiences, you know, including experiencing the voice of God to a degree that I have not since the deconstruction of my faith. And I'm kind of waiting. I'm waiting to see what will replace it. I'm waiting to see, and I'm seeking, what will match that intensity. And where I'm looking right now is in religious humanism. And in humanism, I really feel a sense of reverence and excitement when I think about the potentialities of what we can do, of things that, and thinking about what you just said, Randy, there's this idea of an actualization of ideas of God. One of my working theories of God is actually technically an atheist one, and it is God is the personification of our greatest ideals. But the reason why that could be a real God is because in that expectation and in us engaging with that idea, we create it. I mean, but do you see what I'm saying, Dan? I think that this helps with interpersonal relationships because it's so easy as a non-literal believer. It's something that I always try to keep in mind, to disparage literal belief.
Right.
And to say, oh, well, that's so base, that's so immature, that you need to get with the facts, you need to plug into reality, and I don't feel this way. And so as a check, I just remind myself and I say, what utility, what consequences are there to literal belief that, again, are harder to access with a more agnostic worldview? And one thing that's a balance in my life is I genuinely believe in spirituality. Like I really, truly believe in spirituality and spiritual experiences. And so, for example, I can still give my children priesthood blessings because I believe in the symbol without knowing what the referent is.
Right.
But it's tough. And I honestly don't know. I don't know how I will regain that level of intensity that I had as a literal believer.
Great stuff to put out there. Thank you. Wow, we got you talking, Jared. Let me just have you open up the section that we sort of pre-planned now to say we've laid out the William James stuff, we've got a feel for pragmatism as a general methodology for deciding between competing ideas, and we see how it brings in temperament and psychological forces and emotion and motivation and all those different things. So it's a neat philosophy in the sense that it really plays in multiple areas. But we've got that. You, as I've seen you and discovered through this, is you've been calling yourself a pragmatist for quite a while in our conversations and things like that. But it wasn't necessarily this technical pragmatism. It was more of a felt or a seat of the pants idea that truths that work are somehow in some way true. And so now I just wanted to turn, you know, you no longer have to worry about whether you're being very Jamesian or any of that kind of stuff, but I wanted to just turn you loose a little bit on what you mean by claiming that practical truths mean a lot to you when it comes to religious life and decision making.
I really appreciate that. And this podcast episode has been a great learning experience for me. And I fully acknowledge that I am the least well-read in philosophy in this group. And so now I can speak with a little bit more fluency. I do think there's something fitting that I care what works more than the technical definition. But the technical definition is also, you know, also useful.
Yeah.
So now with a little bit more sophistication, I think I could say, and check me if I'm wrong, I think I could say that I am part of the broader neo-pragmatist position, and I live with a very strong utilitarian ethic.
I think so. You kind of incorporate some of the more postmodern sort of lit crit kind of component of neo-pragmatism too, but that's neither here nor here there, so, you know.
Right.
I'm curious before you go forward. I am curious. Do you, with agnosticism, do you, one, believe there is going to be an ultimate truth in some correspondence way made known to humanity at some future time, either by a god or by evolution? Or do you find that a question that's not even interesting to you because you're much more interested in short-term ethical issues?
Well, for me, it's all a matter of priorities. I mean, I will play any intellectual game that you want. I mean, and I don't mean game in a disparaging way, but for example, debates about the nature of God are very enjoyable, but I just feel very limited because I take agnosticism very seriously. I do have a strong, let me just lay out my three definitions of God that I think are enough to label me a theist. Number one, I said, is the personification of our greatest ideals. And I think there's a lot of practical value in that position. As one of the reviewers of Robert Wright's Evolution of God said, God can save us even if they don't exist. Well, the reviewer said he. Number three is God as a robot. So I don't want to get, it's basically a futurist transhumanist position. So somewhat tongue-in-cheek, I would rely more on evolution and technology in bringing us to that point of perhaps apocalyptic revelation than a spiritual, metaphysical type revelation. What I mean, and this is a good follow-up, and then number two, where this is a belief that's more a hope than a real belief, but I really do think it's plausible, and that is, follow me on this, God is to consciousness as consciousness is to neurons. So it's a little bit Avatar, but the idea is that each of us are made up of trillions of single-celled living beings unaware of our existence, correct?
Okay.
Kind of. Yeah.
So by, and also a lot of like, microorganisms and different things and bugs and germs. So by analogy, I think it is plausible that we something like a Jungian oversoul a little bit, but that we could make up God's soul, and that would allow him to have his own, you know, their own consciousness, just as we have a consciousness. Anyway, so that's my theism. But with that, what really anchors me in my day-to-day activities and engagement is a sort of utilitarianism. And one way that I try to apply this in my engagement in Mormonism, because I'm very, very sensitive to the way that I, as a non-believing member, engage with believing members because I am erosive to them. One, I would not want Mormonism to be me. I would not want Mormonism to look like what works for me. And I do not think it would be beneficial for me to be completely, explicitly honest in my Mormon engagements. It just, not positive consequences. So I am looking for ways to respect and engage with a literal believer. And so this is one way that I take consequentialism or utility very, very seriously. And so when I'm engaging with, and it seems like this is something similar to what you do, perhaps, Randy, with your foundation, is I look at the consequences, I look at the results. And so as a useful interpersonal ethic, and this is where I push against some of the real rationalists or naturalist people who adhere to the facts. And I have some really lively debates with friends about this, is I will give people their beliefs. You know, people can have whatever cosmology, they can have whatever worldview they want. I will give it to them. I will allow for the possibility of that being an option. But I will challenge them on ethical grounds. You know, so for example, in Mormonism, I would say, oh yeah, you know, I speak however carefully I need to. They say, okay, you know, I'm open to the idea that there's revelation, and I think that's useful. And, you know, perhaps God is speaking directly to the apostles and directly to the leaders. You know, but don't you think, what about this modesty talk? And do you think that's potentially damaging to young women and young men? Or what about these lessons about the cupcake? Or what do you think about the shame-based, you know, the shame that this causes? Or, you know, so for example, wow, I don't know if I want to go there as far as personal. Oh, well, she won't listen to this podcast. Anyway, I had a really good talk with my ex-wife. And my ex-wife is a very literal believer. We get along really well. She's a very literal believer that has been liberalized by a master's degree in counseling. And so we had a talk where I said, I'm totally fine with the kids being raised in the church, but, you know, I don't want them to be interviewed alone with a bishop. I don't want them to feel shame about masturbation. I don't necessarily want them to go on missions. I don't want them to be married in the temple. You know, they'd be sealed in the temple. And so what I'm trying to do with religion, and I realize the critique, and I know the wheels are turning in Chris's head especially, is how do we frame religion in such a way where it has maximal benefit? And you and I have talked about this a lot, Dan. How do we for example, I'm thinking of something that I would term common ground Mormonism, where what is a Mormonism that the literal believer would recognize and claim as their own, but an atheist could support? Do you see what I mean? So that's what I mean by pragmatism. And I like the word pragmatism better than utilitarian. Yeah. But that's what I mean, is it's just very, can we frame this in a way that it will have maximal benefit, maximal utility? And that's extremely important in my life.
Cool, thanks. Reactions to either of you guys?
Yeah, I'll take this view. First of all, so you guys don't know me very well, but I literally believe, my tentative belief is that we are not a function of my imagination, that I'm not the only thing that exists in the universe, that I'm not a solipsist. And once you get over that, then all sorts of possibilities open up. And for me, that we exist on this planet is an inexplicable miracle. And with this inexplicable miracle, I have no difficulty whatsoever believing what I take as my belief, that there's a planet someplace else called Kolob, that has our God and his family, their family, the heavenly mother and father, and they're going after it. I have absolutely no problem with that. I believe that God is on yon, as Joseph Smith, on yonder, in yonder heaven sits a man. And I just think that he was killed too soon, because the woman would have come out and more clearly, and I think a lot of things would have been, we would no longer have been Christian. We would have had the truth, the truer truth, I think, that would be more Jamesian. I'll go into a Jamesian mood, that would have been more helpful to the world than our current level of revelation that has not, in recent years, given too many great and important things yet.
Yet to be revealed, Article 9, yeah.
I just wanted to give this as a statement so you guys could know me a little better, because I'm about to say something else. Okay. And so there I am. My working William Jamesian live as if, will to believe position is, we matter to each other, that the most important thing in the universe is love between individuals who are related, and that we want to maximize that love both qualitatively and quantitatively. That's what joy is all about, and that we're following a leadership of a heavenly host of people who are trying to help us along with them in doing that. And everybody's included. I believe the outer darkness, for Pete's sakes, is only locked from the inside, and that there are all sorts of things that we say are going to be finished that we don't know squat about being finished. I believe that God is clearly, to me, an open being who doesn't know everything, and he's very delighted that he doesn't know everything. It keeps him interested in living as an eternal being. Okay, with all that as background said, you can see why I love James's openness to all possibilities. Empiricism goes to the bone. It's always experimenting with what's next and assuming that you don't know enough, that you always want to know more, you want to have more love. You've got a voracious appetite, if you will. And with, having said all that, I'll just say to Jared, I find that whenever I'm in a group of any kind, it's most useful for me to think to myself, I am grateful that they are recognizing me as a member of this group. I am grateful that they are allowing me with their body language and their smiles to be part of this group. And years ago, stopped thinking about looking down upon anybody's position as if I really was sure that I was correct compared to them. But at the same time, I felt I owed it to everybody in the group to say what I really believed. And so I have been very careful, and I don't know how successful I've been in my life, but I've been very careful to create relationships in any group where people know I will go the distance for them. Whatever it is, I will go the distance. I will help them. I will love them. I want what's good for them. I have me winning and them losing is not what it's about with Randy Paul. And if I get that relationship going, then they can put up with almost anything I say, because they know it's my best guess. It's my best honest shot at something based on my faith. And if it's a critique of them and what they're doing, so be it. It's a critique, but I hope to build it on that earlier trust that I care about them and I want to be part of the group, and I'm grateful that they've included me in it. So I think that's all I want to say in response to Jared. Is I felt like when he was talking that he could actually be more effective in doing what he wants to do by being a little bit more honest.
Well, first, Randy, first, you don't know how honest I am or I'm not. I am always as honest as I can be. And I realize that that is privileging my perception of other people's preparedness. Like, I get that. But I do try to be as honest as as I can. I had talks about me being agnostic with my home teaching family. I love what you said about, you know, building on that foundation of service and love. And I agree that people can put up with a lot of idiosyncratic or unusual or oppositional beliefs. But don't you think that, here's what I think, and then you can respond to it how you will. Here's my concern, and maybe it's just pride and self-centeredness, whatever, but I think that I have pretty strong arguments for agnosticism. I feel that I am relatively able, I personally believe that the weight of evidence and critical thinking dismantles all denominational claims. Now, I'm open to them being true. Like, if I die and Jesus is there ready to give me a big hug, like we talked about in the Atonement episode, I wouldn't be like, well, you know, I'll be damned or I'm wrong. I would be so grateful. So I am open. I remain open. But I also think that we have the responsibility as thinking beings to act on reality as we think it most probably is, you know, as far as in terms of investment. For example, I do not believe in the afterlife enough to invest much at all into it. So here's my basic thing. I am sensitive to the idea that potentially, at least, my full, honest, naked worldview could erode and even destroy other people's preciously constructed worldviews. And so I am going to err on the side of caution. And I am not going to give that to someone until they ask for it. Does that make any sense? I just try to be responsive and not proactive. And this is me trying to act in love.
Sure.
I mean, it's not, that's how
well,
I
first of all, I think James would say, we're all agnostics, but we don't have a knowledge meter on our chests. So we don't know what agnosticism is. It's hard to measure agnosticism or what you do know. We don't have a meter that can say that. And so you might not be as alone in your high priest group or elders quorum as you think you are in your agnosticism. We just don't have that meter. So James would say, watch what people do.
Yes, I bore my testimony.
And it seems to me, you're in that sense, you're not an agnostic in your actions, and so I like what you said. Perhaps what I like about it is you've taken into account those you're trying to love, and you don't think it'll be useful to them, using the pragmatic term, useful to them to share your intellectual thoughts at a given point in time, and so you don't do it. I love that. I applaud it.
Yeah. So, for example, just as a final instance before we move on, I literally bore my testimony of the limitations of knowledge, again, from the pulpit. And I talked about how I said that the realm of personal experience is sacred. And when we say, I know, we are speaking to our personal experiences, and that is real. That is real to us. Our perception is real. I said, that said, and that affirmed, when we say, I know, in many other instances, it is because we are conditioned to. And what we mean when we say, I know, is I believe. And here are the advantages of saying, I believe. And I said to all my ward, one of the advantages of using the words, I believe, is that we do not make those who cannot say, I know, feel badly, of which I'm one. And after I said that, several people came to me and said, you are describing me. I am like this too.
Sure.
So what I try to do in my interpersonal relationship is I do give, and I do it imperfectly, of course, but I plant seeds, and I want to model this in Mormon Stories Sunday School. I plant seeds to the greater complexity, both in my internal reality and historical, you know, in historical issues, academic issues. I plant the seeds. I provide the framework that would allow them to deal with both my complexity or the complexities of academic issues in a responsible way, whether or not they pick it up. So, like, here is a productive model of revelation. You may not care, You may not do anything with it. You just may want to continue to drive your religion, which I have complete respect for. Dan, going back to the whole, you know, I can ride this. I really resonate with it. But I really feel strongly about this interpersonal ethic. And I feel that it would be a selfish error to privilege my reality over their reality and say, I'm going to impose that on you.
Well, I think if Randy doesn't have anything to say, I can jump in.
I'd love to hear it, Chris.
My critique is mature, I would say. So to start with, I have a problem with the idea of approaching any person of faith or any person with a worldview with some sort of request that they sort of make peace with yours or sort of make accommodations based off an ethical view that they wouldn't accept. So, for example, if one were to approach we talked about this a little bit earlier, I think, maybe in a personal conversation, but about circumcision. If somebody were to approach a Orthodox Jew and say, hey, circumcision is pretty, you know, it's not really great for the baby. It's kind of, you know, there's a knife involved. It could be framed as harm. Maybe you can stop that and just replace it with a symbol, maybe, you know, little ceremony. I don't think that they would accept a sort of utilitarian argument against their behavior. And I don't even think that that argument would be relevant because that's not what the thing was for. And I think this general line of reasoning applies to missions, temple work. If the church decided to take all of its money and build a gigantic monument and not feed anybody, and they thought that that's what God wanted them to do, I don't think I would have many arguments that I could bring against that.
But this is where I take my stand. This is, and you know this, Chris. I mean, we've had conversations about this. This is exactly where I take my stand. Are you? I don't want to call you out too much. Are you for or against female circumcision?
I'm against it from my viewpoint. Like, I'll make them stop even if I can't persuade them or anything like that. But I don't have any illusions that I'm not going to try to work on their worldview in this case from any sort of negotiation. It's just going to be force. It's not going to be a discussion of peers at that point.
If I get that right, Chris, you're saying if you could be a diplomat, you'd go in to try to get the laws of the country changed without having any theological dialogue about it.
Yeah,
it's against the law.
Yeah. At that issue, I mean, if they control the laws of the land, they're going to make the laws approve of female circumcision. That's just going to happen. But what's happened, at least in modern times, is we have a liberal ethic, right? That ethics involves things like you can't do things to other people without their consent, right? Yeah. It's a set of coherent, or some would say coherent, I think they're coherent, ethical positions that try to negotiate the combination of a bunch of other people's ethical positions, but they have their own arguments behind them. It's a philosophical position, ultimately, and it's subject to philosophical proof or disproof.
I get that, but you are hurting the educator in me. Like, you are making the professor in me cringe, because the is not one of the purposes of an education, and granted, a liberal education. I mean, you wouldn't get this in, like, a Muslim education or so forth. But the idea is that you can affect paradigm shifts through the introduction of new ideas. And we have this idea, this ability as human beings. Okay, here's my proposition. We can argue about the overall utility or the effectiveness of it, but is it not the case that because of empathy, you are more likely to convince someone through an appeal to harm, or, you know, to prevent harm, than a pure, like, philosophical argument about the nature of reality?
I think you're probably right that you might be able to appeal to their emotions more, but people's emotions are conditioned by their society. I mean, it's not as simple as just walking up to them being like, come on, they really don't like this. We should probably stop. Right?
Well, what about that hasn't worked so far? Well, what about this idea of, like, it would hurt you if you cut your penis? You know, would you want this? Therefore, do we really want this for our baby? Before my son was born, my oldest son, I didn't think tons about circumcision, but as soon as the question came up, I instantly reversed my position. And I realize that's my particular cultural context and so forth. Anyway, I think, yes, we can argue about how effectively can you change other people. But all I'm saying is it is a max, I think, and I try to live this way, it is a maximally effective way that the backdoor approach is you allow them the cosmology and challenge them on the ethics. I realize the overlap. I realize the complexity. I realize it bleeds through. But as a way of affecting transformation.
Well, I think for me, it feels a whole lot like a fifth column, like we're sort of
I am
subverting.
A fifth column type person. I admit that. That's part of my activity in the church. And now it's recorded.
Oh.
Well,
okay.
I just don't think you're going to be effective, Jared, in this regard, on female circumcision, from my experience in the Middle East, and this particularly is in Africa, of course, is that the link between what you reject, which is a serious belief in an afterlife, and female circumcision
exactly.
is so intense that the only way to go, in my opinion, is Chris's way. Get more votes and make it illegal because you will not win by making any ethical arguments because the mothers and grandmothers are doing this for ethical reasons. They want the best for their daughters and sons. And this is the way to get the best. This is the way to get them into heaven. It's the way to avoid sin. It's the way to avoid sin. It's the way.
Okay,
you see what I'm saying? That,
yes,
the bottom line. The bottom line is getting into heaven.
It's loving.
The bottom
yeah.
line is getting into heaven.
Just to sort of put a capstone on it, like people who have these beliefs are doing it for internally consistent reasons, and all of your critiques so far can't help but come from something external to that worldview.
I understand that. Yeah, I understand that.
So you might be dressing it up, like from my perspective, you might be dressing it up in Mormon language or in, you know, you might be recruiting symbols, and people have done this since the beginning of time when they wanted to see something change. So I don't see this as somehow particularly devious or new or bad, right?
Sure. I'm just,
but
it's effective.
Yeah. And it might be, but I personally don't really. I don't buy into that as much because it has something about it of the advertiser or of the, you know, skillful rhetorician, the manipulator, right? The sort of
then so be it. But I would respond on the counter argument that religion transforms. And this our specific example of female circumcision, like both instances of female and male circumcision. Dan, aren't you thrilled to have such a vibrant, robust discussion of genitalia on Mormon Matters?
Sorry about that.
all material is spiritual. You know, this is a Mormon discussion.
True.
So we know
more material.
All instances of circumcision are decreasing. Like female circumcision is quite rare, it's decreasing, and. Where I would respond is that religion transforms. And usually what happens is there is a shift. Like people have there's practice and then theology. Like would you disagree? Like usually what happens is there's some impetus that transforms the tradition and then they have post hoc theological rationalization for that change. So
I agree with that. A lot of the times I agree that the circle is the chicken, the egg thing is so tight that it's really hard to know what comes first. But you've made your point, I think, cogently.
Yes. Okay. So I get that idea. And I am willing to do violence to the worldviews as skillfully as possible. What I will say very carefully is I think we need fifth column in every single religion. Like, I don't think this is the type of thing that any outsider can do, because no outsider will have the legitimacy to say the practice that you are doing. So I could not, even though I would want to, I could not go to Jewish people and say, I think circumcision is wrong. I think what would need to happen is what happened, which is the Reform Jews said, we don't know that circumcision is necessary. Do you see what I'm saying? I think we need people within every tradition to ethically question the harm that their cosmology does. And Randy, I, for example, female circumcision, like, and I won't belabor this too much more, there are so many, and I would need to do more research on it, but intuitively it seems there are so many factors, social, patriarchal, power, you know, decreasing the sexual access of the woman. Like, it's not this pure, floaty, ephemeral theology that's going on. Sure. Like, there are very real, bloody, grounded social reasons that have a lot to do with the empowerment and the disempowerment of women, patriarchy, power of men over women, you know, things like that, that I think should be poked at, prodded, pulled apart. And this is where I will take my stand and die on it, is I will fight ethical harm wherever I see it as eloquently and powerfully and effectively as I can. And if I need to attack the worldview, I will attack the worldview. Anyway,
I agree with your analysis completely. I was almost everything I think that you said, I agree with it. I'm not saying it's in the Quran that we have female circumcision. I'm just telling you what is often in the mind of someone who is questioned as to why I do this. It comes back to a deeper. They don't say, well, I was culturally determined to do this by a patriarchal society, and it really has nothing to do with my religion. And I realize that that's not where they go.
No, I get that, but it doesn't make it right.
I'm not saying it does. I'm just saying, are you effective with your goal? The question is then, if we were on a team here and we wanted to ethically help out people in a culture where this was going on, from what I understand you saying, and I think it would be compatible with what Chris has said, you would say, how can we find within that religious culture tools,
yes,
that can, exactly, self-critique?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah, and I agree with that completely.
Super.
That was fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hey, we've gone significantly longer than we planned to, guys. Is there anything else that that you want to tease or at least put out there before we come to a close and turn it over to the podcast listeners in the discussion?
I would like to pump a book out there to everybody who's listening to this one called "The Heretical Imperative" by Peter Berger, a very accessible short book that says the minute you create a group, a fifth column is created. You don't see it, but there's always a heretic. If there's not one, you will create one. Human beings have this desire, whether we know it or not, to always, if you observe groups, to always say, well, we don't quite have, you guys don't quite have the purity. You've lost, in other words, the thing that brings us together only lasts for a little while until one or two people in the group start seeing something. So I don't think we have to worry about fifth columnness. I think it happens time and time and time again. Yep. It's part of any kind of group formation. So, and then that book, The Heretical Imperative, will make anyone feel comfortable about being totally loyal to a group and totally critical of the group at the same time. It's quite a wonderful book. And it
could be like a scripture.
And then the other book that I would recommend to those who really want to go there, it's the Hibbert Lectures, H-I-B-B as in boy, E-R-T, in 1909, the last lectures given by William James. It's published under the title A Pluralistic Universe, in which you'll have to do a little bit of philosophical background reading to get some of his references, but for the most part, he'll take you on a trip that you wouldn't believe when it comes to pluralistic universes, multiverses, polytheism being the most coherent way of thinking of a universe where there's God. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's a wonderful piece of work.
Yeah, it's fun, and it's William James pulling off the shackles, the self-imposed clear-eyed commentator, and now he's exploring and going speculative on us. Yeah, it's terrific. I love it too. Good stuff. Thanks, Randy. Chris, what would be your final? Hey, I want to make sure this point gets at least hinted at.
Well, I just want to thank the listener for taking this little journey with us. I think we gave a decent introduction to especially Jamesian pragmatism, but of course there's a wide variety of voices and figures in the philosophy, so go out and use some Wikipedia, the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. It's an online resource. It's really great.
And, it is.
If you tool around there for a couple hours, you'll be able to look up basically any of the words that we used in more detail than you could ever want, and you'll be able to get your philosophy 101 through there if you want. And I think look to pragmatism. Basically, the takeaway is you need to trust yourself. It's the only one that can evaluate what you are justified in believing is you. Don't let yourself get browbeaten by intellectuals on any side. I mean, listen to their arguments, but there is nobody can claim some sort of epistemological, which is what you should know. Nobody can claim that your position implies that you ought to believe anything except you. There are a lot of soft, difficult things to tease out which go into any of our worldviews. And I think that's what you ought to take away from the podcast. And thanks for having me on.
Yeah, awesome. That was really a wonderful little minute there, that last bit too. And it's just never stop either, it's just this constant motion, constant testing stuff. So I love that. Thank you so much, Chris, and really appreciate having you on. You did a wonderful job as our most recently actively reading philosopher. you helped us a lot in this podcast, so thanks.
Well, thanks. I'd love to be on any other time. So
great. It's been a lot of fun. Much. Jared, what you got at the end?
Well, I now have on my kit for PC a pluralistic universe for free. So everyone go on Amazon and a lot of amazing other, like Will to Believe is free, right. Bertrand Russell. That's not necessarily a plug for Amazon and Kindle, but just to say there are a lot of amazing free books about this, including pluralistic universe. I certainly got lively. Not that I'm unlively, usually. So perhaps I could just conclude with the atheist wager. Even though I don't self-identify as an atheist, I do really resonate with this, which is just live well. I would encourage everyone, I would also thank the listeners for bearing with us, but I would just encourage everyone to have the courage to challenge the social cultural conventions, to look within all the resources that we have, whether they be scriptural or revelatory or interpersonal, for what resonates with us as the very best and very most productive aspects of our tradition, and use that to shape our spirituality in a courageous and an ethical way. So basically, the atheist's wager is the idea that live well and live the best you can, increase the well-being of yourself and others. And if there is a God, God will be pleased that you have lived well. If there is no God, you have lived well. And so what I'm trying to do as best I can, and I fall short, is just to formulate win-win scenarios. And I think that's one.
Terrific. And thank you. Yeah.
I appreciate being here. Thanks to the listeners for listening again to me. And I really like the fact that we've had a discussion that's been real. And thanks, Chris. Thanks, Jared. Thanks, Dan. I would add that in true William James fashion, that the harder we work for a win-win scenario, the reality of life so far is that it always ends up being win-lose. And we've just got to mitigate the lose. All of our good efforts never quite make it so that it's totally win-win. You will always have someone raise their hand and say, ouch. But that should not keep us from trying. So I agree we should try, Jared, but let's not get discouraged when we find it doesn't happen.
Right. Although one final thing, Randy, don't you feel that there's something beautiful in us all working together, though? I mean, I feel like that was kind of a self, my rants were a bit self-focused, but really I love the scientific method. I love the academic method, and I think this can apply to religion and philosophy and culture, is this idea that as we all put forth our best efforts, as we all allow ourselves to be checked and corrected, as we all seek to love, that we are evolving as some sort of greater being towards godhood and perfection. And as we become more and more aware of the harm, we will, you know, repent and diminish it. But it's a good reminder.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It'll be, as Joseph Smith said, sociality, remember? That's what it's all about in heaven. And when you ponder that, that meshes very nicely with his idea that, hey, if I'm the only perfect person in heaven, I want to go to hell. I want to be with people. So that idea that you just brought up, togetherness, is what our God's all about. It's not about morality or perfection in the sense of achieving something outside of human relatedness. It's about us loving each other and wanting to be with each other forever. That desire for continued relationship will be the greatest miracle of all. But that's for another, that's another, another hour.
Yeah, good stuff. And certainly that's where my Mormonism is centered too, Randy. So thank you for reminding us there. You know, I just constantly say it on these podcasts, but those of you out there, and again, I can only speak from, again, what you guys were saying about, you can only, you know, say it adds up for me. But I'll tell you, I wanted to say that if Mormonism for you was the level of Mormonism that maybe you got up through Young Men's, Young Women's Seminary, perhaps a little institute, if that's as developed and deep of a sense of Mormonism as you got, no wonder you're rejecting it now. No wonder things can come along and do it. But I'll tell you, there is a richness and a depth to Mormonism. Randy just hinted at some. We've kind of talked about some and other that I think is really there. If again, we're patient, we have confidence that we can once again pick up the strenuous mood or the scent of truth, and there's motivation ahead. And every time I look hard at Mormonism, it drives me to its deeper philosophical or metaphysical sensibilities, not claims, but sensibilities, the flavor of the universe. Man, I get excited. That's what I love to focus on. And again, I think you can make a difference in your wards. You can help take it deeper too. So that's my two cents there. But listeners, thank you. I'll add my thanks to everybody else's. Please come to the blog, MormonMatters.org. Make comments there. Make donations there. Yay. But mostly, just thank you for all that you do. Thanks for being encouraging to us through your comments and things like that. And again, thanks, panelists. Loved having you on. And wish you all good night.
Okay, good night. Thanks, Dan.
Good night, Dan.
Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
this way.